Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy will join us shortly. She's slogging through the winter wonderland in her jalopy. Stay tuned for Amy coming up on a Friday Morning Answer. We begin today's show with the announcement from Amy's motherland, Sweden. Those Scandinavians have done it again. Denmark, following the example of the UK, declaring essentially COVID is over, although much more forward than the UK when it came to schools being open, the masking requirements. In other words, Denmark, one of those countries that had no such masking requirement for many moons now, declaring it over earlier this week. Now Sweden announced yesterday, Swedish health officials, deciding against recommending COVID vaccines for kids age 5 to 11, arguing the benefits did not outweigh the risks. With the knowledge we have today, with a low risk for serious disease for kids, we don't see any clear benefit with vaccinating them, said health agency official Brid Barkholm. That's what she said at a news conference. Sweden is still experiencing cases like everywhere. As of earlier this week, 40,000 new cases, one of the highest daily numbers during the pandemic for that country. And despite the fact that they're not testing obsessed like the COVIDians in this country have incented so many people to be. Now, they did extend restrictions in Sweden, including limiting opening hours for restaurants and having an attendance cap for indoor venues. But the plan is to remove those restrictions that were extended in 2 weeks by February 9th. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. In the United States, more than a quarter of 5 to 11-year-olds have received at least one COVID vaccine dose as of last week, January 18th. Talk about 8 million 5 to 11-year-olds. Concern you at all that Swedish health officials... So health officials in another Western country that are sophisticated say the benefits do not outweigh the cost. Now, it's not something you haven't heard from health experts on this show, but I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what kind of impact this announcement has. Do the COVIDians and those who need to rationalize their personal decisions as well as their public pronouncements over the last 2 years, do they just say, well, Sweden, you know, reckless Sweden experimenting with people, slow to lock down to their benefit, finally got on the COVIDian board, got on board with the COVIDians with instituting some of the mitigations that the rest of the world had imposed at the outset. Be interesting to see the reaction, if there's any second thought given by parents who've fallen in line to get their 5 to 11-year-old vaccinated based on this news from Sweden. And remember, too, in this country, you have health officials, former FDA vaccine regulators, a couple of them, who resigned after the Biden White House and ran the FDA on boosters. So this united front that the D.C. press corps creates with the help of the TV doctors, starting with that sad little man, Tony Fauci, that there is no dissent within even the ranks of the pro-vaccine, pro-mandate, perhaps previously pro-lockdown for a period of time crowd, because there are. And when you bring up the country of Sweden, I can't help but do what I always do when Sweden is brought up, go back to the former top state epidemiologist in Sweden, who at the outset of the pandemic, so this is April of 2020, we were 2 weeks to slow the spread, and the lockdowns were being moved forward. Johan Gusecki saying, he just doesn't see it. He doesn't see how these things make sense. Of these proposed lockdowns, locking down and quarantining the unsick, it's never been done. He doesn't see how you stop the spread of this virus. There's no evidentiary support for what was being proposed at the time, the magic of 6 feet of social distancing, the masking. And he said, you know, come to me a year from now. So this would have been last April, or 2 years from now, and let's see where everybody stands. Well, let's indeed. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Greg LaGrange, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. It continues, doesn't it? It continues. The complete destruction of the scientific method in the Western world. Johan Gusecki, like you said, and John Lee, and Gerd Wisniewski, yeah, those people that you've had on your shows in the past, have measured reasoned responses to this and a wait and see with caring for those most at risk. Why is it that Sweden, Denmark, and some of the European countries are basically saying no to these COVID shots for children less than 12 years old, but our country is going full steam ahead with that COVID shots for those 5 to 11? It's the fact that this is not being discussed is in a worldwide forum among scientists. It just screams caution and danger. And it's not the parents I worry about. I think most parents won't have their children exposed to this kind of risk because it's unknown. And I don't even know how much this stuff has been tested. It's been said that it hasn't been tested to a great deal on younger children. So, my concern is that this is just going to be pushed out in this country, and they're going to push this narrative all the way to the end. It's the end game. And the testing, why test if you're asymptomatic? Why not, if you're going to go that far? I think it was on Eugypius that somebody said, if you're going to test when you're not sick, why don't you go to the graveyard and see if you're dead? I mean, this is absurd.
Well, right. I mean, I test today, but I don't have to test tomorrow. Why? I mean, right. Then what is the purpose of yesterday's tests other than unless it's the means to gain entry into some place or to have access to something? The testing only makes sense in the context of symptoms, right? Or right. Mandates, because otherwise you'd be testing every hour. This is an airborne virus. What are we talking about? Thanks for the call, Greg. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Oh, hey, thanks, Dan, for taking my call. Listen, the U.S. is never going to basically go along with shutting this thing down or anything. It's all about the politics, nothing about the science. They used science in the beginning as an excuse and all that, but we are the test subjects. All the rabbits from the original testing and all that, they had a whole colony of them. They're all dead. They all died. This fiend, this Fauci fiend, is running this test. And that's why he wants the kids. He wants this test on, just like he was killing all those little dogs and everything like that. The kids, he don't care. This is going to go down in history someday when they figure this thing out. It's unbelievable what they're doing to victimize American people.
Thanks for the call, Craig. And again, we're not just talking about concerns being raised for 5 to 11-year-olds per what Sweden announced. You know, not recommending vaccines for 5 to 11-year-olds. Love some enterprising reporter. Maybe that stupid son of a bitch, Steve Ducey, will, or Peter Ducey. Wait, I always forget the two. Peter Ducey is the kid, and Steve Ducey's Fox and Friends. Yeah. Peter Ducey will ask Psaki about that. What do you say to Sweden? But in addition to that, we're also talking about, again, the under discussion of adverse outcomes. And as right now you have military men and women being drummed out of the Air Force for failure to comply with the vaccine, we have this story out of from Just the News. This is John Solomon's website, justthenews.com. DOD medical data reveals surges in off-site vax adverse events. Three military doctors say medical billing code data captured by Defense Medical Epidemiology Database shows sharp spikes in miscarriages, myocarditis, cancer diagnoses, Bell's palsy, and female infertility. According to the data found by the military doctors, there was nearly a 300% increase in cancer diagnoses, for example, the average between from 2016 to 2020 as compared to 2021, last year, when the vax mandates went into effect and military men and women started getting vaxxed. 300% increase in cancer diagnosis. Now, is that causative? No. Is there a temporal correlation? Yes, and it requires more exploration, but it's an issue to be raised and discussed and better research so that we know if there's something more serious here than just happenstance. And then the same goes with adverse outcomes reported in the VAERS site and so on and so forth. One of the things that still humors me is too flippant, but and baffles me would be inaccurate. I don't know what it does to me anymore. I'm numb from COVIDians. You know, it was serious enough, the incidence of myocarditis in young people, young healthy people, such that the FDA moved to mandate warning labels on the vaccines, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. And yet there's no discussion of that. To suggest what is true, something that was moved by that same FDA that is otherwise generally lauded by the COVIDians, except if they're not going fast enough to advance the flag of safetyism, it's just not discussed. You say it and you almost feel like, wait, is that still true? Is that true? I heard that. Is it really a thing? Nobody discusses it. Well, it was enough of a thing to mandate slapping those warning labels on. Tim in Woodstock, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning, Dan. You know, I'm reading the book 1984 now, I think, for the first time. And I think that was partly on listening to you talk about it. And in that, I noticed they just simply remove language, you know, so that people just forget things after a while. They keep revising the dictionary. But
yes,
my point
speak,
was that,
right.
Yeah, that's right. There's no words of caution from schools that I've heard. And these are educators. You know, the educators should be the ones raising questions and being skeptical about things. And their attitude is just roll the dice, just go along with, you know, with what's going on.
They have a position and they're sticking to it. And right, come what may, that's basically the attitude.
Yes, just fall in line. Just obey. And just as a side note, Dan, my mother-in-law, she through the Prospect Heights Park District, she's been going from time to time to a lifeline screening. And she was turned away yesterday. She was turned away yesterday for not having a vax card. It just struck me as a little ironic to be turned away from a lifeline screening because she didn't have a life card. She was told to go home and read her paperwork. She went home, reread her paperwork, and she found nothing on there about having to show a vax card to get the lifeline screen.
It could have been worse. She could have needed a heart. Thanks for the call, Tim. Appreciate it.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So we got the UK, we got Denmark declaring COVID over. We've got Sweden, as we were talking about before the news.
We got
declining to to push vaccines on 5 to 11-year-olds.
Good. We've got Czech Republic declared COVID over. That's good. So
the dominoes are the dominoes are falling, and we also have this convoy coming to Ottawa up north there in Strange Brewland.
Did you say we got a convoy?
You got a copy on me, Big Ben? Come on.
Love this movie.
Yeah, 10-4, Big Ben, for sure, for sure. By golly, it's clean, clear to Flagtown. Come on.
Woo!
Yeah, that's a big 10-4 there, Big Ben. Yeah, we definitely got the front door, good buddy. Mercy sakes alive, looks like we've got us a convoy.
Yeah. Did you ever
some
see that
of
movie?
Chris Christopherson's greatest work, no question.
Love that movie.
So that fifth grade drama teacher that they put in charge of the country up there in Canada,
yes.
He addressed this convoy, 50,000 strong, heading towards Ottawa, saying, pay no attention to that convoy. Those are fringe people
yep.
who are
crazy,
just not with the program. But the good news is that 90% of Canadians are. And so, you know, press forward and, you know, go get your unborn child vaccinated.
We know the way through this pandemic is by getting everyone vaccinated.
Yeah.
And the overwhelming majority, close to 90% of Canadians, have done exactly that. The small fringe minority of people who are on their way to Ottawa or who are holding unacceptable views that they're expressing do not represent the views of Canadians who have been there for each other, who know that following the science and stepping up to protect each other is the best way to continue to ensure our freedoms, our rights, our values as a country.
The way we get through this is to get everybody vaccinated because, as we know, once you get vaccinated, right. you can't catch COVID.
Oh, no, because everybody we know who has COVID right now has been vaccinated. Even some have been boosted.
One of those individuals with an unacceptable view, that's an interesting phrase for a prime minister to use, unacceptable view,
wow.
is a Canadian hockey star, two-time gold medalist for his Fair Canada, Theo Fleury. He was on with Laura Ingraham, and he talked about this convoy, and he's he is in full support of it. And he'll tell you why.
Is right now in Canada, we have one of the biggest revolutions happening, and you probably haven't heard about it because nobody's talking about it. But right now there's 50,000 truckers and about 1.4 million people headed to the parliament in Ottawa, and they're going to stay there until Trudeau resigns or they give us back all of our freedoms and rights. You know, wow. when you separate people, it's easy to, you know, to create power through separation. But like I said, what we're seeing in the country right now with these truckers and it honestly, it has ignited the whole entire country of Canada. And I know that, you know, I've been spending a lot of time on social media helping, you know, promote the truckers and getting their word out and all of that. And so even I, you know, big tough hockey player have, you know, shed a few tears because I haven't seen my country this behind something and this excited about something in a very, very, very long time. So
it's pretty encouraging news from that rather genteel and compliant nation called Canada, because Canada has also been home to some of the greatest excesses, particularly in Quebec. And I'm not just talking about the ban on dog walking. You have and maybe I should say that some of that heavy handedness is finally registering and the truck drivers shall lead the way. We had that truck driver beat the Senate President in New Jersey, remember Edward Durr?
Oh, that's right.
Now we got these truck drivers that are going to free Canada. What about the truck drivers in Illinois?
The freedom.
Somebody sent some truck drivers to Springfield?
I know. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA. Excuse me, then a quick comment. Because they're going to get to the Capitol by Saturday. And oh, guess what? Trudeau's in quarantine because he was, are you ready for this? Exposed to somebody who had COVID. Mm-hmm. Aren't we over? That's so last year. to quarantine because you're exposed to somebody? You test to, you know, make sure you have it and go back up.
I'm still in last year when it was, if I get vaccinated, I can't catch COVID. That's what the president of the United States said.
Oh, that's right. And that it's going to be, COVID's going to be in a rearview mirror by 4th of July so we can, you know, then have picnics with our families.
Yeah, that's right.
Barbecues. Remember that lie?
Yeah. So, well, whatever. I mean, Trudeau's sort of also a pathetic little man, like so many in charge in this country. In Quebec, just to give you perhaps another example of why this revolt that Theo Fleury was talking about is happening. I mean, you know, you can call it a fringe minority, like the prime minister there did. I don't know, 50,000 truckers, 1.4 million people. That's a pretty big response, as we've seen pretty big responses in Western European nations protesting draconian lockdowns and mandates over the last year.
And there was an organizer of this event called Freedom Convoy on with Tucker Carlson last night. And he said, you know, it's scary. You know, we have to get vaccinated. We understand that. But this QR code that's on your phone, he said, I went up to the border and I was going to show the agent my papers. He's like, no, we already know. And he said, oh, what do you know? He goes, well, we already got your QR code from your phone in the cab of your truck as he was pulling up. He said, that's what's scary. So now they can track your movement. And he claimed that the government, that Biden's working with Trudeau to have this, you know, throughout North America, where they can track your movements as a citizen and then as a visitor to Canada.
Well, they've looked at this. They're pursuing people who've applied and or received religious exemptions, medical exemptions. I mean, this is, again, the path of least resistance to extend state power, to do it under the guise of it's for the public health.
Oh, yeah. It's all about safety.
So here's Quebec. Here's what give you an example of what's happening in Quebec that maybe people are tiring of.
Today, big box stores that have a footprint of 1,500 square meters or more are going to have to ask people, customers, to show proof of vaccination. Now, pharmacies and grocery will be exempt from this. So if you're going into a Costco or a Walmart or something like that, where you might be going in to buy groceries or visit the pharmacy, in that case, an employee will have to be with that person as they walk through the store to make sure that they do not go and buy other products or other items that might be in the store. Now,
babysitters? You're going to have a babysitter walk around with you?
I wouldn't call it a babysitter. I think health warden is probably a better description.
No.
And a whole new bureaucracy. You could have these people dispatched to monitor your purchases. I mean, employees, I guess you could just mandate that they be hired by employers. But I like the government agency. You know, cut out the middleman. Government agency better. If I want to go into a store, I'm only allowed to buy these certain things. So then I got to call for my health warden. It's like my parole officer,
right?
to come and monitor me to make sure that I don't attempt to buy anything that I'm not allowed to buy because I'm unvaccinated.
312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I mean, this again
is scary.
All of these things that are the fodder for dystopian novels of the last 50 years are actually happening. And I think people have a difficult time believing that this stuff is true, but it is. Chris and Dan Ryan. I'm the Dan Ryan. Chris.
How you doing? Yep. How you doing? Hello.
Good.
Can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead.
Two hands on the
wheel. All right. Yep. Snowy and the Dan Ryan. I have a friend that lives in Quebec. Him and I text pretty much every day. Just in regards to this whole COVID thing since it started, and the comments that he says are just absolutely uncommon sense. They don't make any sense. He has not talked to his son in over a year because his son does not want to get vaccinated. And when they had a birthday party, they did not invite his son to come with.
Ugh.
I just think that's ridiculous.
Thanks for the call, Chris. The other Chris and Carrie.
Hey, Dan, I got a question for you. As someone who went to law school, if a politician admits he was wrong or says, you know what, after careful consideration over the past year and a half, 2 years, we've realized that maybe some of the stuff we've done has been incorrect. Does he open himself up to litigation? I mean, I would have much more respect for someone who came up and said, hey, you know what, we were wrong on this this particular thing, blah, 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 blah.
No, there's no, there's a, I mean, no, there's no... legal exposure for a politician that says, "Here, what I did was wrong. You know, upon further reflection, that was the wrong policy. This is why we're changing course." This is sovereign immunity that you have as an office holder for the public policy decisions that you make. Now, you're still, at least in theory, not so much in Chicago, but you're still at least in theory under the same criminal and civil strictures of the regular citizen. But what you do in your official capacity as an office holder, you're almost without exception insulated from, you know, civil liability. So there's no like, oh, I would run out there and admit I was wrong, but I just, you know, can't afford the legal fees. No.
Why do we never hear that, though?
Why don't you hear politicians say they're wrong? Because they're infallible, so they're never wrong, Chris. You know better.
I was asking a rhetorical question.
Yeah. I mean, they don't admit they're wrong, because then that will be used against them. It's so much easier, rather than to be honest and admit that you made a mistake or admit you were wrong. I mean, except when there are no other options left, and that's when you'll get an admission after every other possible option has been exhausted. The reason they don't is because, oh, well, then it'll be used against me. He said this, and then he said this. When in point of fact, when you're so obviously wrong, as these lockdown politicians were, you would get so much more street cred by saying, here's the basis on which I made the decision. You know, as we see the consequences and weigh them in retrospect, it was the wrong decision. And I've learned from that, and I hope other people learn from that, too. It's rare that happens. But these politicians, they're just so up their own behinds that they can't behave like a human being. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
Doubling down.
Yes.
Keep pushing the chips for add more chips to the stack. You
know, right.
I'm all in from the beginning, and I'm going to keep adding more chips because I know I've got pocket aces, but I know I'm beat by a full house. But I'm just going to keep going.
Yeah. Thanks for the call.
Well, Dan, when hasn't a politician admitted that they were wrong, and said it so eloquently as you just put it?
Well, the other thing too is it's just easier to not. It's just easier to rely on people's rather poor short to medium term memory. If I just keep repeating the words science and data and public health and saving lives
and
protecting the kids, then, you know, what I said 2 months ago or 2 weeks ago, that's not material. I'm still in this business. We're still doing it. And I'm adjusting based on what my experts are telling me, because we're all here saving lives and protecting the public and doing wonderful things. And I'll admit some mistakes were made. I'll never define with any specificity what those mistakes were made. I'll just pretend to have some humility by saying generally mistakes were made. Mistakes made themselves. I mean, this is the cant of the politician, because they're incapable of accepting responsibility. They're incapable of actually having the buck stop there for most of them. And it's just easier. And frankly, that's a bit of a failure on the public, too, because if you had a bit of institutional memory and you bumped up what politician A was saying 2 months ago or 2 weeks ago to what they're saying today, and you notice some sunlight between those positions, then maybe that would be the story about that politician that gets out, rather than just the rinse and repeat of it's wonderful. He's up there saying, I'm saving lives, I'm following the science, I'm relying on experts. This is an informed, measured, thoughtful leader we have. Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, Dan and Amy, good morning. Dan, do we not reach a point where the cautionary tales of yesterday become to be looked upon, that these guys have used them as textbooks for today? Sometimes the coincidences are just, they're too close.
Yeah, those authors from a bygone era look like fortune tellers, don't they? Tom in Deer Park.
Hi, Dan and Amy. I'm not calling about the anti-vax. I have no truck with that group. But you made me chuckle. I didn't know that Theo Fleury was on Ingraham Engel last night. But I have seen the news. I don't know if you guys remember Ronnie Duguay. He played with the New York Rangers and then the L.A. Kings. He was party central. And so I see reports of him running around with Sarah Palin in Manhattan. So I don't care about the anti-vax right now. You just put two old hockey players in the news, and thank you for the chuckle.
Okay. All right, sure.
He knew she had COVID, and he hung out with her anyway, so what? He had a choice. He made his own choice. Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are they still alive today? Yeah, everything's going to be okay.
You know, on the COVID thing, I mean, some other people, like actual health professionals on like just radio talkers like me, have pointed this out. But, you know, thinking about the Sweden thing, too, and all this stuff. And what you just mentioned about Palin hanging out with that former hockey player. So doesn't it require, in order for the virus to go endemic, that people get it?
Right. People need to get it. Yes.
I mean, I'm not wishing it upon anybody. I'm not advocating for it. But I mean, it's just like the reality that we're confronting, how this is going to actually go down, is that people are going to get it. Mm-hmm. They're going to develop an immunity, 99% of them under the age of 60. Some people, unfortunately, are going to get sick. Some people, unfortunately, are going to die.
Because people die every day. People forget that. People are trying to stop deaths. And those mainstream media reporters press room. I'm like, people, do you understand that when you go into a nursing home, you're not going back to your regular way of living. You're going to die. People die. Well, they're trying to stop deaths. It's never going to happen.
Okay, but a failure to confront reality, and it doesn't need to be like people will die and we're throwing up our hands. It's just you want to get to this place, you say, and you think you can get to this place without incident, without illness. I mean, it's a complete misrepresentation of everything that the virologists and immunologists and molecular biologists know about viruses. I said, we just the magical thinking in America. I don't like what's going on. I can wish it away. And I don't have to confront sort of the physical realities of the threat.
I'm just frustrated because Dr. Awardi said, you know, we're going to treat COVID as just the seasonal flu. Well, let's start right now, here, right now, and not
that
wait.
That could go two directions. People keep saying that. That could go two directions.
What do you mean?
I mean, they could treat the seasonal flu like we've been treating COVID.
Oh, dear God. I mean, remember 2017, 2018, when they had to put up tents outside of Rush Hospital because the flu season that year was so bad? So, we had a bad flu.
Yeah, I don't remember it. Because that's because we handled it
differently
as best we could, rationally making sensible trade-offs between, freedom and the protection of the public health. Karen and Beecher.
Good morning. Hey, I just wanted to share with you all the good news that the school district in which I work finally rescinded the vaccine mandate. I was to be let go on February 3rd, and we got the good news yesterday that they let go the vaccine mandate. And
what school district is that?
Flossmoor School District 161.
Good for you.
Very good. Thanks for the call, Karen. Appreciate it.
And people that were fired. Oh, sorry.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So you heard of the news, Joe Biden's announcement. Joe Biden's got a new cat.
Yeah, Willow. They just got him. He's a gray tabby. And the reason why they have him is Mrs. Biden, Dr. Biden, not a real doctor, was at a campaign rally in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania. And she was speaking outside a farmhouse. And this gray tabby jumped up on stage and was sitting right next to her. So she said eventually she was going to take the cat. She did. Isn't that exciting?
That is a wonderful story. I mean, they're just such wonderful homespun people.
Just like you and me, Dan.
Joe and Jill.
We have cats, too. We love the feline friend.
I do not have cats.
Well, you grew up with Angel.
Yeah, I did have a cat.
You did?
Yeah.
And didn't you have to bury Angel in the backyard when Angel died?
I did.
Your mom made you do.
Well, he kept trying to get out of this makeshift coffin.
Ew. So,
no, I'm kidding,
I know.
Obviously.
Right.
I don't want the feline lovers to, you know, go full PETA on me. All right, so the other thing that Joe Biden talked about yesterday, in addition to the cat, I mean, it's not as important as that, but it's the idea of filling the seat that is currently held by Stephen Breyer on the Supreme Court. He's going to do that by the end of February, so he said, and, of course, recommitting to make history, because that's what the left does, make history by identity. That's all they care about, is identity. That's really the focus. Oh, he threw in qualifications and character. And I was interested in this tweet from Joe Lockhart. You may remember Joe Lockhart. He was the Jen Psaki for the Clintonistas for a time.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Ahead of the midterms, tweeted Lockhart, I look forward to watching every Republican senator oppose the first black woman to the Supreme Court. I want you to take that in.
Can you say that one more time so we can process that?
Ahead of the midterms, I look forward to watching every Republican senator oppose the first black woman to the Supreme Court. In case it was not clear that minorities are nothing more than mascots for the new Marxists. And I'm not saying that who Joe Biden nominates, this D.C. appellate court judge, Brown Jackson, or the other names that have been mentioned. I don't know their, I haven't had time to read up their opinions. I don't know their history. I know that Brown Jackson was just confirmed by the Senate last year to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and that included the support of three senators. I think it was Graham, Collins, and Murkowski, the Republican senators. So I'm not sure that's the case, but regardless of whether that turns out to be the case or not, and setting aside the qualifications for a moment of whoever Biden nominates. That's such an interesting statement by Lockhart, isn't it? I look forward to watching every Republican senator oppose the first black woman to the United States Supreme Court. Doesn't matter who it is. It could be Tanya Acker, my choice from Hot Bench. it could be anybody. It could be Whoopi Goldberg from The View.
It could be Michelle Obama. She's an attorney, right?
You don't need to be an attorney. That's
oh,
why
that's
it could
right.
be Whoopi Goldberg.
Right.
Whoopi Goldberg presides over the TV. It could be Whoopi Goldberg. Doesn't matter to Joe Lockhart because he just looks forward to every Republican senator opposing the first black woman to the Supreme Court. I mean, he's saying we're just going to play racial politics here.
Right.
And because you couldn't oppose a black woman nominee to the Supreme Court unless you were what? A racist and probably sexist, too.
Right. White supremacist, yeah.
I mean, is it bad enough for black Americans? Is it bad enough? I'm going to nominate a black woman because it's important.
And he doubled down on that yesterday.
Is that not bad enough? Then you have statements like, and that black woman I'm nominating is just going to be a tool for us to try to salvage the midterms, really, to try to reduce the damage we've inflicted on ourselves that's going to be felt in the midterms.
Right, because any white Republican senator who opposes or even, you know, pushes the button a little bit against her is going to be deemed and labeled a racist and sexist.
And so with all of this black-white business, making history, it's important. Supreme Court do a little bit better job of reflecting the demographics of America and so on and so forth. What does that call to mind? How about when George Herbert Walker Bush made history? Thurgood Marshall was, of course, the first black Supreme Court justice, but made history for Republican president to nominate a black man to the Supreme Court. How did that
Clarence
go?
Thomas.
Clarence Thomas from the documentary Created Equal, which if you haven't seen Created Equal, do see it. But Clarence Thomas, both on how the left played the race card with him, as well as just a reminder for entertainment value of what a dumb frack Joe Biden is. Now, remember, this is 35 years ago, so the suggestion of senility has nothing to do with this. Well, it's not 30 years ago. And that interplay between Joe Biden, the lawyer, and Clarence Thomas, the judge. First Thomas.
Time capsule.
We know exactly what's going on here. And to pretend that it's for some other reason, stop. Do I have, like, stupid written on my back, the back of my shirt? I mean, come on. We know what this is all about. This isn't about what they say it's about. So people should just tell the truth. This is the wrong black guy. He has to be destroyed. Just say it. Then now at least we're honest with each other.
And that's what it was.
Well, yeah, and yesterday on The View, Sonny Houston or whatever her last name, Houston, she's like, well, he's not a real black person. I'm like, what? He's not because he's a Republican? That's I mean, how the disparaging, how rude and just dismissive.
And how
racist.
How banal that is, because they've been saying that for 30 years.
I know, but they brought it up again yesterday and it made me mad.
Clarence Thomas and Joe Biden, and Clarence Thomas reflecting on the exchange between Joe Biden. Well, it wasn't much of an exchange because he just sat there patiently and listened to Joe Biden blather on incoherently about natural law.
Senator Biden was very focused on natural law. How did that go?
Who knows? I have no idea what he was talking about.
I just want to make sure we all know what we're talking about here, that you and I know at least what we're talking about here. There's a fervent and aggressive school of thought that wishes to see natural law further inform the Constitution than it does now, argued against by the positivist led by Judge Bork. Now, again, that may be lost on all the people. You know and I know what we're talking about.
I have to be perfectly honest with you. You sit there and you have no idea what they are talking about. All I know is that he was asking me these questions about natural law.
Someone may apply it in a way, like Moore, who leads him in a direction that is, quote, liberal. You may apply it in a way that leads you in a direction that's conservative. Or you may, like many argue, not apply it at all.
What is talking about?
But it is a fundamental question that is going to be almost impossible for non-lawyers to grasp in an exchange. But you know, and I know, it is a big, big deal. And in conclusion,
one of the things you do in hearings is you have to sit there and look attentively at people you know have no idea what they're talking about.
Where did you find that? It is fantastic.
Created Equal. It's Created Equal, the documentary on Clarence Thomas's life, which, as I said, is must viewing if you haven't watched it. But and that exchange between him and Biden, I mean, that to me is like the definitive Clarence Thomas and the definitive Biden. And it shows one gentleman in a very positive light and another gentleman in not such a positive light, doesn't it? Yesterday, too, after you had Biden's pro forma identitarian statement, Stephen Breyer spoke briefly. And I don't think the American public has ever heard Stephen Breyer speak outside of his confirmation hearing.
He had a copy of the Constitution in his pocket.
Yeah, and the irony of Stephen Breyer waving around the Constitution was not lost on me. I'm sure it was lost on most Democrat socialists. But nonetheless, you understand when you listen to him why there was such a push to get Breyer to retire so they can make this political play in advance of identitarianism and what they believe are their electoral fortunes.
Of course, people don't agree. But we have a country that is based on human rights, democracy, and so forth. But I'll tell you what Lincoln thought, what Washington thought, and what people today still think. It's an experiment. It's an experiment. That's what they said. And Joanna paid each of our grandchildren a certain amount of money to memorize the Gettysburg Address. And the reason that what we want them to pick up there, and what I want those students to pick up, if I can remember the first two lines, is that 47 years ago, our fathers brought up created upon this here a new country.
He's 83.
A country that was dedicated to liberty and the proposition that all men are created equal. Conceived in liberty. Those are his words. And dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. He meant women, too. And
threw in women.
We are now engaged in a great civil war to determine whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. See, those are the words I want to see, an experiment. And that's what he thought. It's an experiment. And I found some letters that George Washington wrote where he said the same thing. It's an experiment. That experiment existed then because even the liberals in Europe, you know, they're looking over here and they're saying it's a great idea in principle, but it'll never work. But we'll show them it does. That's what Washington thought. And that's what Lincoln thought. And that's what people still think today. And I say, well, I want you, and I'm talking to the students now. I say, I want you to pick just this up. It's an experiment that's still going on. And I'll tell you something. You know who will see whether that experiment works? It's you, my friend. It's you, Mr. High School student. It's you, Mr. College student. It's you, Mr. Law School students. It's us, but it's you.
See, here's the problem with Breyer, with a party that is dominated by the new Marxists. He believes in this country. I mean, Breyer has many faults. He is wrong on so many things, starting with the premise that the Constitution is this living thing and needs to keep up with the times, so to speak. I mean, Breyer's been on the wrong side of so many bad decisions. So this is not a defense of Stephen Breyer's jurisprudence. He's an old school lib.
Right.
But he's an old school lib who believes in the country.
Yep.
And the modern Democrat Socialist Party and these political activists in robes that the Democrat Socialists are trying to shoehorn into the judiciary at every level, including the high court, they don't. That's the big divide. You believe in this country or not? Breyer believes in this country. Wrong about a lot of things, disagree with a lot of things, but you can hear it there. Invoking the Founding Fathers, what modern Democrat Socialists will do that?
Ugh, they don't even know who the Founding Fathers are. Having a copy of the Constitution in your pocket? Do you think no, they wouldn't do that.
Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Oh. Yeah, Amy, I have a copy of the Constitution in my purse.
You're nominated.
Thank you.
You're in.
All right, for Biden to stand up there and say that he's going to find the most qualified person ever in the whole world, going to be the best nominee ever, but he's not going to be white male, and he's not going to be a white female. She's going to be a black woman no matter what. It doesn't matter. That is discrimination. It is so blatant and so out there. And nobody else in the world, they couldn't find anybody else to nominate except for a black woman. The dumbest thing I've ever heard him say, ever. That's stupid.
That was his campaign promise, you know, back in 2020. Or not 2020. I don't know what year is this. But he's promised all along he was going to hire a black woman.
Yeah, you know, the irony about Biden's pronouncements is it undermines the credibility and whatever the career record is of whoever he nominates. That person, that woman, that black woman is just reduced to being a black woman because that's what he led with.
Right. That's how she's labeled.
Right. So that it's infantilizing whoever his nominee is, just like the left infantilizes minorities generally. That's what Joe Lockhart's doing. You're a political tool for us. That's it. We're going to try to jackpot the other side. We're going to be able to play the race card, and we're going to see if we can reduce our expected losses come November. That's the top line of it. By the way, to the irony of this, too, mentioned yesterday that Biden's statement runs afoul of actual Supreme Court jurisprudence in the Bakke case, in the Grutter and Gratz cases, University of Michigan cases. And also, it's interesting, considering one of the cases before the court right now, Jason Riley wrote about it in the Wall Street Journal the other day. We've talked about it before. This chance to remove race from college admissions. There is the Supreme Court has now agreed to hear cases challenging the use of race conscious admissions policies at Harvard and the University of North Carolina. you know, at Harvard, where they were artificially reducing the character scores of Asian applicants because, right, you know, you don't want too many of those Asians. Yeah. And so could you imagine in the Supreme Court, and I think they will, and I hope they do, moves to eliminate race as a basis for college admissions at the same time the President of the United States uses race for his Supreme Court nominee, as the basis for his Supreme Court nominee? Joe, Naperville.
Yeah, my dream is that somebody sues Biden and files a complaint with the EEOC for discrimination, and that case goes before the Supreme Court. That would just be hilarious.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Hi, good morning. Senator McConnell here. We have a nominee that President Biden will be presenting. And I can assure you that the Republicans will treat the nominee in a very dignified manner, unlike the Democrats did to some of our nominees. I mean, I've been here for a long time. I remember the Clarence Thomas hearings. Hell, I remember the Bork hearings. I mean, the Democrats were very, very, very mean spirited in those hearings. And, you know, but anyway. I also want to clear something up. I mean, sometimes there's this nickname for me called Cocaine Mitch.
Yes.
I've never done any cocaine. Never. I don't know why they call me Cocaine Mitch.
What about China Mitch? Are you offended by that, Senator?
I haven't heard that one. But Moscow Mitch, I've heard. I'm offended by that. I can tell you that. I mean, I do like a good bottle of Kentucky, or a good glass of Kentucky bourbon every once in a while. But not cocaine.
Thank you, Senate Minority Leader McConnell. Frank, otherwise, that's pretty good. How long have you been practicing that?
Well, actually, just a day or two. Because
that's perfect.
I've had that for a while. But
you got the cadence down beautifully, and the sort of the rap. Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty damn good.
Thank you. But
I'm looking forward to your one-man show.
I got to get you. I'm going to do William Howard Taft today in school.
Oh,
I'm gonna have. It's gonna be really good. So
you're gonna pack on the pounds.
He's gonna wear
and do the seventh inning stretch.
He's gonna wear a J.B. Pritzker suit.
Well, give us a William Taft. Come on, what do you got?
Well, it's not really. He was an indecisive president. He had conservatives on one side and progressives on the other. So I get one kid. I have all these senators' jerseys. So I have one kid wear a Senator Alfred Beveridge jersey, and then another one wear a Nelson Aldrich jersey, and. Then they, like, ask me to do things or not do things, and then I just am, like, indecisive, and I go, oh, no, oh, what do I do? Oh, I don't know. I go back and forth. It's classic.
Then you have to
remember
do
William
the
Howard Taft is being indecisive. That's the whole skit. So
and very
that should
heavy.
Be good.
I'm going to renew my request to audit your history, your high school history class.
Yeah, can we have a visit, please?
I just want to see the theatrics.
Let me know when you're in town, because I got Wilson coming up next week. I got, then I'll do FDR in a couple weeks. So.
All right, well, if you're going to do Wilson, just don't screen Birth of a Nation for your class, all right? I don't want to get you in trouble.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Frank. Appreciate it.
Well, we speak in a number of classes, so he should invite us to speak in front of his class.
I don't want to speak. I just want to be entertained. I want to see Frank and his theatrics with his kids as the bit players. You know, it's like whatever. I don't know what school he teaches at. But
he won't tell us.
Yeah, well, for understandable reasons. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
It's snowy Friday.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So all this talk of who is going to run against Mayor Triple Threat next year. Before we get to that, maybe we should talk about who is going to run against Jesse Sharkey and his Politburo, as it's currently constituted, that controls the Chicago Teachers Union and, by extension, the Chicago Public Schools. Well, there is a candidate who has made herself known. She's put together a slate called Members First. She's the candidate for CTU president, and then she's got a slate of candidates for the lesser offices. Her name is Mary Esposito Oosterbowski, And she joins us now. Thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
How long have you been in CPS?
I have worked for Chicago Public Schools since 2018.
Oh, so okay. So you're recent.
Long time.
So when you came in 2018, I've been teaching.
I started teaching in Chicago Public Schools back in 1998.
Okay. And you're a school psychologist now?
I'm a school psychologist now. I have when I started in 98, I worked as a teacher, and I went to school in the evening and advanced my education, became a school psychologist. And in my time that I worked as a school psychologist, I also worked as a counselor and case manager, and I've been working now back as a psychologist for a number of years.
Okay, so what? Give us. So then you have actually a very good longitudinal perspective here. Give us the trajectory of the Chicago Public School System from your perspective over the last 24 years.
Well, I think from my perspective that as a teacher and as a school psychologist, that our members have been working really hard for a very long time to try to work to improve working conditions and educational outcomes for children. And I do think that there's been struggles along the way and an attempt to make headway.
So what is Jesse Sharkey, Stacey Davis-Gates doing wrong, and why do you want to replace them?
So the current leadership of the Chicago Teachers Union, they see work stoppages and strikes as the first step and not the last one. They're far more focused on advancing their own political careers than delivering for us members. We need a union leadership that's going to deliver way more than two KN95 masks for 4 days of lost pay.
So the last straw for you was this last work stoppage. I mean, we've had 5 strikes or work stoppages in 10 years. So every 2 years and every time your contract's about to expire, they go on strike. And I know because I've been here for 10 years, my kids go to CPS and I'm a coach for CPS. So it's been hell. And seeing what the psychological damage it's done to kids is you can't get that time back.
I understand your frustration. A number of people are frustrated that it's always the first step and not the last one. Members first, we want to work with all parties, parents, and make sure that we have the best educational outcomes for our children.
So how do you think CPS is doing with respect to those educational outcomes?
I think there's a lot of progress that we have to make. I think teachers every single day go in, all of our members, from our PSRPs to our clerks to our itinerant teachers to our clinicians, all of our members go in and give 200% every single day. This pandemic, the effects of gun violence, poverty, they play out in our classrooms each and every day. And so having a union that delivers for us is essential. But that's not what we have every day. And our members need support. They need resources.
Resources. So the 2019 contract gave Chicago public school teachers 16% pay hikes over 5 years, not including step and lane increases. That was about $1.5 billion worth of cash that Lightfoot signed the bottom line on with no available funding sources to pay for it. Was that a good deal for both teachers and parents, students, city taxpayers?
So our union needs to focus on delivering for members. I mean, our pay and our benefits and our insurance, all those things are super important. It's not the only focus that was a part of that contract. We fought for a lot of things, a nurse in every school, social workers. I mean, we talk about gun violence and poverty. We need our clinicians. We need our social workers, our psychologists, our school counselors to be able to provide the social emotional support that our students need. Our teachers need resources, our clerks, our PSRPs, the people that are working with our children every single day need the resources in order to benefit and provide the support social, emotionally, and academically to our students.
Can you understand how people, once they're presented with the numbers, are a little perplexed about the Chicago Public School System? It's about $28,000 per kid that's spent. You have a declining student population and declining rapidly. And that trajectory has been in a 45 degree angle downward for the last decade. And we hear the problem is not enough money and not enough staff. We need more people for fewer students, and we need more money to produce better results, even though that's sort of a constant refrain. We never get exactly what the magic number is. It's just always more, and the outcomes seem to be consistently less in terms of preparedness for college or the workforce.
So what I would say to you about that is $28,000. If you look at student-based budgeting, I'm going to guarantee that that's not the money that's going into the schools to provide supports and services for the children.
Oh, I agree with that. Oh, I agree with that, so but that's a fundamental
so
problem.
Important. I think when people hear that that's how much money is being spent, and I know that's not what's going into the budgets for administrators to provide the supports and resources for children, then I think, you know, that's the conversation that we can have. I also, you know, you talk about the pandemic and gun violence and poverty. Those are three things that have impacted our students this year. Gun violence and poverty for many years. And so looking at equitable resources to ensure that students and teachers and members, clinicians have the resources that they can provide the social, emotional, and academic support that children have. We're coming off of a pandemic. I mean, there's children that haven't been in school for over a year and a half. And
what did you think of being out of school for, I mean, last year our kids had 12 days of in-person learning. That's it for all the entire year. Cause that's, you know, the stupid hybrid 2 days a week. And I'm talking about high school students. Elementary kids went back earlier, but did you agree with that move?
So I went back to school in January. Our clerks and our techos were back in the building at the beginning of the school year. Special education teachers, preschool, early childhood.
I know what happened. I was there. I was there for it. I'm just asking, did you agree with Jesse Sharkey and Stacey Davis Gates, what they did and what they told the union members to do, not to go to school?
I'm not quite sure what you're referencing.
Well, what you remember, they were working online outside of the schools. They didn't want to go inside the schools because they can't teach from the grave, all of that. I'm just wondering if you supported that move or did you think it was safe to go back into school?
I'll say this. Members shouldn't have to fight for basic safety and resources for their students. So, like, this, the passing that happened, you know, just a few weeks ago, where we were out, locked out from Chicago Public Schools and working remotely.
You guys weren't locked out. You didn't show up for work. I mean, some teachers did.
So
they didn't care.
We actually were locked out. So I could not get on my computer. So nobody could do any work.
Yeah, but
and
but,
so what I'm saying, here's what I'm saying. You have children in Chicago Public Schools, and you're saying that it's frustrating, and I hear you. And so what I would say to you is that I don't think teachers should have to fight for basic safety standards. I know in many other professions that people just get resources. They don't have to beg for masks for their children. They don't have to beg for their classrooms to be clean.
Yeah,
and I don't think that teachers should have
Mary.
To...
Mary, come on. There has been plenty of masks there since 2020. I mean, there's been masks. The classrooms are clean. Where are the classrooms not clean? Where are there not masks?
There are classrooms all over the city of Chicago that are not clean.
Okay. Would the janitors go on strike or what? I mean,
I can guarantee you, ever since this pandemic has started, there has been shortages with staffing.
So what does that have to do with anything? Then clean it up. Does COVID transmit on surfaces?
No.
We've known from the spring of 2020 that's not the case. So what is this emphasis on a clean desk or a clean chalkboard or whatever? So clean it up yourselves. I don't know. You that the system is run like an old Soviet agrarian co-op. So, yeah, I'm not surprised that money is wasted and jobs aren't done because it's a centralized system that is incapable of producing what it promises to produce. So if you want to think about reimagining the system rather than just sort of a different angle to the same demands that we hear from Jesse Sharkey and we heard from Karen Lewis before him and saying, but you know, don't go on strike. Don't be so quick to go on strike. I mean, to me, that's a distinction without a difference. What is happening inside the walls when you're there, or more to the point, when nobody's there, like as you just said, for the last year and a half? You believe the last year and a half was the appropriate policy response from COVID, then I don't see much sunlight between you and Jesse Sharkey.
So there is a difference. Our goal is to work collaboratively with all stakeholders to ensure the best educational outcomes for students. We really want to focus on what our members need and what is going to directly impact our students. And we have an opportunity for change. We really do. Members are frustrated. You are talking about, as a parent, you're frustrated.
Well, nobody ever talks to us. Nobody cares what we think. Members. Nobody cares what the parents think and what the kids think. You never ask the kids.
That is our goal.
You never ask the parents.
Our goal, we want to work collaboratively with all, I mean that sincerely,
okay,
with all stakeholders. Kids need to have a voice. There's, you know, our high school kids, our elementary kids, they need to have a voice, our parents.
Who's the primary stakeholder in the system, in your opinion? Who should be seen as the primary stakeholder in an educational system, a school district?
Who should be?
Yeah.
Who's the primary stakeholder
in kids' education? Who's the primary stakeholder in Amy's kids' education?
I didn't hear you cut off.
Who is the primary stake? My broadcast partner here, Amy Jacobson. Who is the primary stakeholder in the education of her two sons? In CPS,
most definitely, the parents are a huge part of this process. And you're saying you don't feel that you have a seat at the table.
Yeah, that's true, and that's the correct answer.
So we have to. You have to agree that we have to come together and work together. We can't keep arguing and fighting and name-calling. It really sets a terrible example for our children. As a school psychologist and someone that provides social-emotional support to children, we've got to set a better example. We have to learn how to reach out a hand. We're not always going to agree. I'm sure there's things, even in this conversation that you and I just we're having, there's a lot of things you don't agree on, okay? Mm-hmm. And I understand that. We're not always going to have to agree, but we're going to step forward every day and put our best foot forward for our children and to focus on what our kids need for the best educational outcomes for their future. They are our future.
Mary,
we have to make sure.
Right. As a school psychologist, do you see a time? And well, first of all, do you want to go to school ever without masks on? And how do you think those masks are affecting our children?
I follow the guidelines that are provided by the CDC. I mean, and I always have. So things are going to change. I mean, things change and evolve. And I have, since we started, we're following best practices in the school. I regularly have to do training to ensure safety for children and to ensure that I'm doing what I need to do. I do have to clean surfaces. There's been, as year from year, as this has evolved, this pandemic, I have done everything that has been recommended to me by our medical specialist.
Right. But
so,
do you think
look, I understand the position you're in. Okay, you've got a membership that, by the way, all these work stoppages that you say they're too quick to go on strike. Well, of course, these strikes have been supported by overwhelming numbers by the members. So, I understand you're in a difficult position, and you're not going to turn the Chicago Teachers Union overnight into something that it's not currently. So there's gradations. So I get it's a difficult position. But it seems to me that if there's not like a bright line choice presented, then why wouldn't those apparatchiks in that union, and if that's name calling, you can call it name calling. I just call it descriptive of who they are as how they've presented themselves. Why would they just not stick with the people that they've supported every step of the way?
So I think a lot of members are very frustrated. They don't feel that the focus has been on them. They feel that our leadership is focused on advancing their own political benefits and goals. And so they want an opportunity to be represented and to ensure that working conditions are improved for themselves and for their students.
So when you say they're interested in advancing their own political goals, this is like you're talking about, for example, like Stacey Davis Gates prattling on about considering running for mayor and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we want our union leadership to focus on what members need primarily and mm-hmm. how those things are going to benefit the students that we service every day.
And if you were elected and your slate was elected, would you commit to no work stoppage? Would you commit to particularly, you know, in this COVIDian era, to no more remote learning, that under your leadership, CTU is going to figure out a way to make sure teachers and kids are in the classroom?
I'll promise you this, that we're going to provide transparency in every single thing we do. Our goal is to work collaboratively with every single stakeholder to ensure the best educational outcomes for our students. We have an opportunity to vote for new leadership in CTU on May 20th, and I really hope that that's what members do.
All right. She is Mary Esposito Usterbowski. She's a school psychologist in the Chicago Public School System, and she's the head of the Members First Slate. She's running for Chicago Teacher Union president, and she's got a slate of candidates running for those subordinate offices as well. Mary Esposito Usterbowski, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mary, and good luck. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Last week in our conversation with Special Report host Brett Baer, we talked a bit about these emails that have been uncovered from the beginnings of the pandemic in the winter and spring of 2020. The back and forth between Fauci and Collins, Western experts like Robert Gary from Tulane, Christian Anderson from Scripps, about the origins of the virus, and concern from Collins and Fauci and then others falling in line that if they allow the notion that the virus originated in the Wuhan virology lab to take hold, that would be problematic for international harmony, I think was the phrase that Francis Collins used. And so they wanted to immediately move to tamp down those debates and get everybody on board with natural origins. Well, Brett, subsequent to our conversation, put together a really nice piece. It's about 11 minutes long, and it's worth a listen, but I'll give you a couple of highlights in case you missed it.
I watched really nice, all of it. I mean, I've been addicted to it. I watched, you know, three nights in a row. It was so good.
Really, really good. Just walking you through the timeline and what was said by who, when, and then now you have the backdrop. You have the benefit of 2020, and you have the backdrop of how this all unfolded, and then taking it back to, well, to borrow a word, its origin. So this is February 4th of 2020. Fauci, Collins, Western experts, including those two experts in the field I mentioned, Gary from Tulane and Anderson from Scripps, they start to churn, well, I would argue, maybe this is too strong a word, propaganda. They start to, Gary and Anderson reverse their positions on the possibility of a leak from the lab to publication of arguments that suggest, no, more likely than not, natural origins.
Just 4 days later, five American, British, and Australian researchers who were all on that Fauci conference call authored preliminary findings that abandoned their earlier private beliefs that COVID was likely the result of a laboratory leak. It's unclear what new evidence prompted such a drastic 180, but private communications show the various drafts of their report are sent to Fauci and Collins for editing and approval. The records do not reveal if they in fact edited the new version. February 16th, the first public draft is published online. Weeks later, a final version of that report is posted. Again, a total reversal of what those virologists wrote in private emails earlier. March 17th in Nature Medicine. Our analysis clearly shows that COVID is not a laboratory construct or a purposefully manipulated virus. But that was not enough to tamp down what multiple sources inside and outside government believed, that the Wuhan lab was indeed the COVID ground zero.
And then one more clip of Fauci then on April 17th.
Yep.
And the timing of grants that were distributed by NIH to some of the principals who authored that study that you just heard Bayer reference.
The mutations that it took to get to the point where it is now is totally consistent with a jump of a species from an animal to a human.
More than a month later, we now learn Drs. Christian Anderson and Robert Gary, two of the authors of that scientific report who were in close contact with Dr. Fauci, are awarded a nearly $9 million research grant from Fauci's agency. A month after that, Dr. Peter Daszak of EcoHealth Alliance, the group that did the original U.S.-funded experiments with the Chinese at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, received a $7.5 million grant over 5 years from Dr. Fauci. President Biden, a year later, tasked the U.S. intelligence community to probe the COVID origins.
And, well, let's now get to the gentleman who put together that story. Brett Baer, he is the host of Fox News Special Report, weekdays, 5 p.m. Chicago time, of course. Number one bestselling author of To Rescue the Republic, Ulysses S. Grant, The Fragile Union, and The Crisis of 1876. Brett, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, I'm not just trying to feed your ego by playing your stuff back to you. Just sort of set the table. So after all that investigation you did and putting together that timeline, so what are the takeaways you have in terms of the questions that are pending, in addition to the obvious one, the origin, the questions that are pending about the handling of this from beginning to present?
Well, I think there's a list of questions. By the way, we've engaged NIH and Dr. Fauci, and they just haven't answered any of those questions. And one of them is, what changed in the 48 hours from when Gary and Anderson and others are on a conference call raising questions about they can't see how this virus could do it evolutionary, could jump just by its how it is acting and how it's constructed, to 100% it went from a bat to a pangolin to a human. And what happened in those 48 hours? There's nothing that was not out there prior to that. So the communications indicate that there was a lot of kind of herding the cats. And why? Why is that? You know, it's evidence that we funded some of that research through EcoHealth Alliance. I think it's fair to say there was a big worry that we'd be swept into all of this. Not that definitively U.S. research created COVID-19, but that there was the possibility that the U.S. could be implicated.
Well, then why, you know, Dr. Robert Gary from Tulane, that $9 million grant he got, why exactly was he awarded that money?
Well, that's a good question, too. You know, all these guys operate in grants. It's kind of like they're feeding off the largesse of the NIH, and specifically Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins. They distribute these grants. It's a normal thing, but in order to get them, you know, they have to play by the rules.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know this to be true, but, you know, the timing of this and the progression of this, I mean, this suggests, you know, you help me on this campaign, and there's a patronage job for you on the other end of it. There's a contract for you on the other end of it. This looks like, you know, old school machine politics, possibly.
Well, it does look like that, and it's fair to just lay that out. But it's, you know, we can't definitively say that.
Right.
Because, you know, we don't have that answer. We're asking those questions, but we can lay out what is private and what's public. And it's fair to make a circumstantial case, at least.
And the other thing, too, I mean, per your reporting about this back and forth and whether and these the articles that were ultimately published being sent to Fauci, did he review, did he edit? And if he even saw them, to then go out on the cable news shows and reference that article and not disclose that you had a hand in it. You know, that's problematic, too, ethically.
That's definitively true. That definitively happened. And it started from the White House briefing podium, where he references this Nature Medicine article like it is a detached thing from his world, that he's referencing these scientists that on their own have come up with this conclusion as the reason he gets to evolutionary jump. But he does not disclose that not only did he kind of help start it, but he was sent to suggest and edit that very piece.
Yeah, you know, it's Matt Taibbi has a good piece in his Substack about misinformation and all this censoriousness that's going on in big tech and so forth. And he just has a good line. He said, the only thing that's worse than the misinformation that everybody's complaining about from Joe Rogan or whoever is official misinformation. That's the most dangerous misinformation of all.
That's true. And so what we don't know is we need answers for that. Now, why do we need them? Because knowing the origins of this thing could potentially prevent another thing down the road in the future. But more importantly, what's the implication of no transparency
right
in one of the biggest health crises we've ever seen?
I wanted to get your reaction to, sort of in the context to a tweet from Joe Lockhart, former press spokesman for Bill Clinton. He tweeted out yesterday, ahead of the midterms, I look forward to watching every Republican senator oppose the first black woman to the Supreme Court. It sort of shows your hand in case it wasn't obvious that we're looking to play racial politics with whichever black jurist Joe Biden nominates, and that's our primary objective.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the big issue here. It's not that they're hiding anything by the president coming out and saying, I am picking a black woman. And you know, there's all this question about whether that's affirmative action, essentially, as the Supreme Court takes up these big affirmative action
right
cases. But I think the bigger question is what it's going to be attempted to be used as politically. And I don't think he's right. I think there are people like Susan Collins and others, Lindsey Graham even, who could vote for a very qualified liberal justice if there are not problems. They've done it before.
Well, yeah,
the midterms are coming up, so they have to. This is their last hope, don't you think, to bash Republicans one more time?
Yeah, but the problem is if the Republicans don't play along. I mean, listen, it's not going to shift the ideological bent of the court. So if it's someone qualified,
yeah,
they've done it before,
right,
where the person doesn't have a problem.
Well, right, and you know, many times, and going in both directions in a bygone era. I mean, Antonin Scalia, I think, got 86 Senate votes for confirmation. I don't think he'd get 86 votes if he was nominated today.
No.
So it's just a different environment. But I mean, to your point, and Kim Strassel writes about this, too, in the Journal today, he nominates somebody by the end of February. And it's somebody like that D.C. appellate court judge, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who's already been confirmed just last year. Well, then Republicans, enough Republicans moved to confirm her before the spring. Okay, well, now we're back to talking about inflation, whatever's going on in Ukraine, the border, and all the other things they don't want to talk about.
Exactly. I think Joe's misplaced here, and just by saying it, kind of the game is up. Now, that's not to say that Republicans are not going to try to block somebody that they don't feel is qualified or on their own political side do what they do. But there are Republicans, I think, who would look at this and say, you know, they have the right, elections have consequences, and if this person's qualified, they should get my vote.
Right. Who's on the short list? Is there anybody? I mean, I know I've read many publications, but any big surprises, do you think, that we'll see?
No, I don't think so. And the whole Kamala Harris thing is, I just think, you know, it's just chatter. It's not real. She's going to head up the committee. It would almost be like Vice President Cheney, you know, heading up the committee for the vice presidential selection for Bush.
Yeah, after careful review, I found that I'm
careful
the most qualified.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Turns out.
Yeah. It's a bitter irony. So Sweden yesterday announced that their public health officials have decided they are not going to recommend vaccines for kids 5 to 11 years old, saying that with the very small chance of the very small risks associated with COVID and 5 to 11 year olds, the dangers outweigh the benefits is essentially what they said. So, you know, you're starting to have some dominoes fall both around vaccinations, around opening up countries, Denmark, UK, Czech Republic. You know, how long till it comes to the shores of blue state America, do you think?
I think it's going to take a while, judging by the healthcare infrastructure and what's happening. It's almost going the other way as far as it seems, getting more vaccines and more access to young people. But I think each one of these events raises eyebrows, and eventually science says, well, let's look at the data. And we're not there yet.
Well, and Dr. Scott Gottlieb, excuse me, was just on MSNBC moments ago, and he's calling for lifting COVID mitigation mandates as aggressively as they were put in place, because he said that the country is exhausted by this pandemic and that mandates are not needed.
I think that's the way to go. And if you look at the midterms, I think there's going to be a lot of politicians and possibly politicians on both sides of the aisle who have that message.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, once you lose the Atlantic on masks and Scott Gottlieb on mandates, you're in trouble.
It's over.
You're in trouble. That's right.
Checkmate.
Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, special report, weekdays, 5 p.m. Chicago time. Number one bestselling author of To Rescue the Republic, Ulysses S. Grant, The Fragile Union and the Crisis of 1876. Brett, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Famed Chicago restaurateur Rick Bayless.
Yeah.
He's saying that Chicago restaurants will be devastated if there is not federal relief. And I'm not, and he's not talking, I'm talking about
federal.
I'm talking about today, he's saying that. I'm not talking about, you know, back during the lockdowns a year and a half ago.
Well, this
he's
is worse than the lockdowns. I mean, nobody's in restaurants, Dan. Nobody.
So, to give you some sense of what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Open table reservations posted a little data table.
Yeah, on their app.
The seven-day average for the week, January 18th to 24th, mm-hmm. So last week. The seven-day average reservations for that week.
How much?
Over the last 3 years, what the change is.
Okay.
So has it gone up or down?
Oh,
what's the average?
Well,
right?
Okay.
They ranked the top 45 cities, you know, the big cities. Miami's number one in terms of positive change, plus 14%. Mm-hmm. Their average increased the week for last week over the course of the last 3 years. Fort Lauderdale is up 10%. See if you can pick up anything.
I'm picking it up, what you're laying down already.
Naples is Florida, plus 2.5%. Scottsdale, plus 1.7%. Vegas, plus
1.5%. Yeah, free state.
On the other end?
Where they have vaccine mandates to get into a restaurant, what's it like?
The bottom 10?
Mm-hmm.
Chicago, minus 55%.
I knew it. See?
Brooklyn, minus 55%.
Oh, my God.
Seattle, minus 59%. Portland, minus 59%. New York minus 61%, San Francisco minus 62%, Philadelphia minus 64%, Minneapolis minus 65%. Reservations down by half to two-thirds in these lockdown COVIDian cities. That's what Bayless and these other restaurateurs are talking about. You think PPP only lasted for so long. At some point, you know, you got to get customers back.
Well, you should start by telling Mayor Lightfoot, drop the vaccine mandate. We're on the other side of this, the surge, which she promised she would do, and we're still sitting here twiddling our thumbs and being a bunch of idiots.
2 years in, we still have no appreciation for the devastation that we will view once the waters have receded. So come the summer, let's see what the landscape in Chicago and big city America looks like.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Before we turn our attention to land war in Europe, just one more comment about what we were discussing before the news. Rick Bayless, celebrity chef, calling for federal relief for restaurants, lest the devastation be even more substantial than it's already been. We went through the numbers from Open Table, how much reservations are down in major cities in America, starting with Chicago, 55%, to San Francisco at 65%. And Bayless saying, you know, nobody knows what to do. He's talking about restaurateurs in terms of how to keep their doors open. Well, just one point I didn't mention.
What?
Hey, Rick Bayless.
Yeah.
Maybe supporting vax mandates as he did, not such a good idea.
Good point. You reap what you sow.
There's been a lot of willing participants in their own damage, I'm sorry to say, in this era of COVID and COVIDian lordship. All right, switching gears, let's talk to our old friend John Bolton, former assistant to the president for national security affairs and U.S. ambassador to the U.N., also the author of The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir. John, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Glad to be back with you.
So, you know, this confidential overture that Secretary of State Blinken made to the Russians that he mentioned earlier this week, hoping that diplomacy will prove productive and keep Putin out of Ukraine. One aspect of it that we haven't discussed much, and I wanted to get your take on, is how Blinken is folding in perhaps a relaxation of sanctions against Iran as a carrot for the Russians to stay out of Ukraine.
Well, there's a lot of obviously uncertainty about exactly what Blinken is up to, but I do think it's without question the administration for 1 year now has done almost everything it could conceive of to try and get the 2015 Obama nuclear deal with Iran revived, and giving away something to the Russians to get them interested might well be in the zone of possibility here. I mean, I think it's the propensity of the Biden administration to think that if they can just find the right thing to concede to Iran, the right thing to concede to Russia, the right thing to concede to China, that everything will be fine, is central to the problem. It just will increase the appetite of the potential aggressors. It won't appease them, to use that word.
It seems to me that there's a fundamental misunderstanding about Iran and this relationship between the Chinese, the Russians, and the Iranians, the Russians and the Chinese want the same thing with Iran that we want, and unless we want those three countries to be the dominant powers in the world, then we don't want the same things, because that seems to be pretty clear from those three countries what they want.
Yeah, their relationship isn't entirely coterminous, but it's good enough for government work. The Chinese want Iran because it's an oil supplier. Of course, they want Russia for that reason, too. Iran stands against Israel and pro-American Arab states in the Gulf region, and that's a plus for them. So they've got a lot going there, and I don't think we seem to understand that. And, you know, the administration listens to the rhetoric about Sergei Lavrov, Russian foreign minister, says we don't want war, and they take great comfort in that and say there's a sign of hope for diplomacy. Well, what did they think Sergei Lavrov was going to say? We want war? Of course he's not going to say that. And it's this naivete, this unwillingness to see beyond the rhetoric of Moscow and Beijing and Tehran, for that matter, that leads us further into trouble.
So we have the Olympics starting February 3rd. Do you think anything is going to happen before that? Because if Russia and China are, you know, together, they don't want anything to take away, you know, China doesn't want anything to take away from the world watching the Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, I know that's a theory out there. I also think it's a theory that the invasion starts while the opening ceremony is underway.
Oh.
I mean, this is something that I'm sure China and Russia are talking very closely about the interrelationship of these things. But to say, why don't you wait 2 weeks or so until the Olympics are over, is just not something Russia is going to agree to. If it doesn't suit Putin in terms of timing, sure, he'll agree to it. But if he thinks he needs to move sooner, or during the Olympics, he will determine the timing. I just don't think there's any kind of deal on this.
Blinken also said earlier this week there's no daylight between the United States and our NATO allies. The story.
It's absolutely wrong.
Yeah,
it's just absolutely wrong.
And well, and just one point, and then I'll let you respond. The story out yesterday that with over 40% of the EU's natural gas supplies under Moscow's control, European officials are now scouring the globe asking for American help for shiploads to redirect to their countries.
Yeah, look, President Reagan warned Margaret Thatcher and other European leaders during his term as president, do not become dependent on Russia for oil and natural gas. And they didn't pay attention to it. And now we're suffering part of the consequences. The Germans, I think, are the biggest problem in the alliance, although the French aren't being terribly helpful, nothing new there. But, you know, Germany, given history now, no country in Europe should be stronger against the violation of international boundaries with military force. No country in Europe should be stronger than Germany, and because of their history, and they are probably the weakest. They just fired their highest-ranking naval official for basically taking up Putin's line about Russia's treatment by the West. The top guy in the Navy just got fired. They have not committed, the Germans have not committed to sanctions on the natural gas pipeline Nord Stream 2 if the Russians invade. The State Department keeps saying they have, but if you look in Germany, they're very equivocal on it. And that's part of why Putin doesn't take Biden seriously. He's heard threats like this before. He heard threats like this in 2014 when he went into eastern Ukraine and annexed the Crimea, and he got away with minimal damage. And I think he may think he's in the same position today.
Well, don't you think Germany's going to sit this one out because they're reliant on Russia for natural gas and oil?
Well, that's a big problem, and as are other European countries. But I think more than that, it's just Germany doesn't want to get into a difficult situation with Russia. And so other countries that, you know, are inconveniently sharing borders with Russia, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Hungary, Romania, are terribly worried about this Russian threat because it won't stop with Ukraine. And if the Germans don't realize that, you know, I think we've potentially got a serious internal NATO issue here. And Putin knows that, and if he can squeeze in there and make that split more painful, he will do it.
How much does our energy policy inform Putin's moves? You know, you've got the EU scrambling the world over for more energy. Well, the U.S. is in that position, too, because we've decided that energy independence here isn't such a great thing under this president.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely backwards. It's backwards for the U.S. economically. And it's backwards strategically, too. I mean, the Biden administration, one of its first foreign policy actions, waived sanctions on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline as it was shutting down the Keystone XL pipeline and saying, you know, you got to get rid of all this dependence on fossil fuels. That's a lot easier said than done. And the Europeans, and by the way, our Asian friends as well, would love to get more supplies of American natural gas and American oil, not be dependent on the Middle East, not be dependent on Russia, not be dependent on suppliers that are politically dangerous for them. So we've got this huge asset. It would have a very positive economic effect, and it'd be a major strategic alternative for our friends around the world.
We've heard differing assessments of the kind of fight that Ukraine could put up, the kind of damage it could inflict on Putin if Putin were to, you know, formally invade rather than to try to foment a coup as he's done in other client states. What's your assessment of what Putin is more likely to do?
Well, over the past two decades, he has substantially improved the fighting capability of Russia's conventional forces. Nobody should have any doubt about that. And it's also the case that he doesn't necessarily need or want an all-out, full-scale, total invasion of Ukraine to take control of the entire country. He might go in and only use the words only in quotes, take more chunks of eastern and southern Ukraine, which is where more Russian-friendly elements of the population live. He might shoot toward Kiev from Belarus, where, by the way, the Russians have just put in significant new troop concentrations. Kiev's near that Belarusian border, and he might want to come right up to the gates of Kiev, in effect. The Russians did this in Georgia in 2008, approaching the capital, Tbilisi, before withdrawing. The Russians may think that'll help overturn the Zelensky regime. There are lots of variations on what Russia's options are here. And, you know, Putin will be looking at what the potential cost is. But in terms of who would win that fight, there isn't any question who would win. The question is, how bad would Russia suffer if it launched a much larger operation than that minor incursion that President Biden sadly all but invited last week?
And your assessment, because again, differing assessments here on these overtures to, you know, crippling sanctions is the term. It's not sanctions. It's always characterized as crippling sanctions. How crippling are the sanctions that the U.S. could impose in terms of, you know, targeting Russian banks and freezing the assets of Russian oligarchs and maybe Putin himself? Is that something that's a part of Putin's consideration?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have the capability to impose really very painful sanctions. There's no doubt about that. The real question now is whether Putin believes it. I mean, we may be in a situation because of America's damaged credibility and the evidence splits in the NATO alliance that Putin simply doesn't think that Biden can follow through. I mean, this is the danger of miscalculation. And I think Putin's view right now is also informed by the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which was a catastrophic strategic mistake. Same view in Beijing. So Biden could be very serious about these crippling sanctions, but you could also have a situation where Putin doesn't believe it, and that could lead to hostilities.
He is John Bolton, former assistant to the president for national security affairs and former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., author of The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir. Ambassador Bolton, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Glad to be with you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, now this is just hysterical.
What?
NPR asked NPR readers to share their dreams for the world in 2022. You want to know what the dreams of NPR readers are for the world in 2022 in rank order?
I don't want to know, but yeah, okay. Climate change has got to be number one.
Well, they want a pocket in their NPR tote bag for their mask. No, I'm making that up. All right, here they are. Connecting more with nature. Leaning into kindness.
Oh, yeah, right. They're so kind, those liberals walking around.
Investing in refugees.
Of course, yes.
And
climate change.
Good instinct. A 2-degree drop in global temperature.
A bing, two, bing.
2-degree
drop. A 2-degree drop? What? What is wrong? You can't make this stuff up.
Yeah, you have to remember who NPR readers are. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
Tomorrow is the first Sunday in May, and it's one of our favorite holidays.
I like
a delicious dish.
That's right, Margaret Jo. Every year for one day, we celebrate and say thank you to dietary fiber. As you all know, Sunday is National Dietary Fiber Day, and we've celebrated that together for years.
Yeah, and even though we've been friends for a long time, you could say our shared love of fiber keeps our relationship brand new.
That's funny.
Thanks.
You took the D off brand and made it Bran.
Bingo.
They're a fun group, those NPR readers.
Yeah.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. It was iconic in Chicago. Remember the Playboy building? Now back to its previous name, the Palmolive building.
I remember Warner Saunders used to tell me he would sneak in there at night. And then he snuck out. He's like, that's not what I was expecting. But he never pontificated on that.
Well, there is a new 10-part docuseries on A&E called The Secrets of Playboy. It began this week. Ooh. Here's a trailer.
There was a side of Playboy that nobody wants to talk about.
He was an advocate for sexual freedom and the First Amendment.
And he really did believe he owned these women.
There's some things that I never saw the light of day.
I didn't realize that getting into the Playboy world was a dangerous choice.
He didn't want people to know what was really going on.
I have extensive electronic equipment in the house, which includes videotape equipment. Sometimes things happen in the bedroom.
It was a beautiful world. It looked that way, but it was really ugly.
When you get someone that powerful, anything could happen. Anything.
I wouldn't trade places with anyone else in the world.
His legacy should comprise the whole story.
The people who are really there, they're the ones who know the real truth.
Ooh. One former Hef girlfriend, Sandra Theodore, claims that Hefner would tape women all the time. He mentioned that extensive electronic equipment. Tape women all the time, oftentimes without their permission. He would also tape athletes and celebrities having sex with other women without their knowledge. Mm-hmm. He admitted, she says, to an interest in snuff films and even bestiality. He allegedly once made porn star Linda Lovelace perform oral sex on a German shepherd while he and others watched.
He loved blondes. And remember the last couple that he was married to were those blonde twins from Joliet?
Okay, you're just going to gloss over what I just said?
I know. The bestiality thing is absolutely disgusting. And that's what Linda Lovelace said. Yeah, he made me do that.
Hello, Caligula. Oh, but he was this celebrated, feted raconteur, Renaissance man, and so on and so forth, and it was all glam. Gosh, imagine Hollywood not upholding standards of moral rectitude, even as they lecture the nation on said topics. Also, we understand from the daughter of his longtime doctor that he had a long-running gay affair, I guess, with his doctor, too. So, nothing was off limits for Hef. What a wonderful empire.
Yes.
He had a TV, right, those two twins. He had a TV show with mm-hmm. them. Hollywood facilitated this exploitation that is now being complained about in this 10-part docuseries. How should we assess this reveal by A&E? For more on the topic, pleased to be joined by Christian Toto, founder of Hollywood in Toto, TOTO.com, HollywoodinToto.com. The right take on entertainment, award-winning film critic and author of the just-released Virtue Bombs, How Hollywood Got Woke and Lost Its Soul. Maybe they lost their soul, some at least in Hollywood, well before they went woke. Christian Toto, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
How about you know, the Playboy that was celebrated to now a Playboy empire that's being vilified. And oh, by the way, I have also saw a report that Christy Hefner, his daughter, who took over the business, she found a bunch of revenge porn that she claims she's now destroyed.
It's not hardly surprising. I think anyone with such power and such wealth and such sort of celebrity clout, they can do almost anything in our culture. And that's I think that's beyond Hollywood, including Hollywood. But Hollywood is very good at looking past their moral flaws and getting on a soapbox. They seem particularly expert at that that kind of activity.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting if this would have come out, if these women now speaking out would have spoke out while Hefner was still alive. Would he have been given something akin to the Harvey Weinstein treatment? Or is the Harvey Weinstein fall from grace, is that just sort of Hollywood covering its tracks from its past and present sins?
Yeah, I think it's more of the latter. The Me Too movement and Weinstein's fall was so fascinating because it seemed like something genuine and heartfelt and a cultural awakening that we all could appreciate. And then, as I mentioned in the book, what happened next was it became political. It became, we will choose the people that we hound for allegations, and we will choose the people that we ignore for allegations. It's, Hollywood can't kind of get its story straight.
I wanted to get your take on another controversy du jour. That's Neil Young, Rogan, and Spotify. I mean, boy, what a surprise. Spotify exercised the courage to side with the guy they paid $100 million for his podcast.
Well, you know, you say that, and I get what you're saying as far as the financial situation, but we've seen other companies buckle when it wouldn't make sense financially to do so. When ABC cut ties with Roseanne for that awful tweet, they lost a lot of money because that show is a cash cow. Mm. And they said, we would prefer to kind of get rid of her from our network than keep making a lot of money. And I know they kind of reconfigured the show, but it was never the same. So I don't always think with show business today that it's about money, money, money. It sometimes the virtue signaling will leap that. So I don't, you know, Spotify is standing tall now, but I don't think that's a guarantee.
No, well, and I mean, and also, too, it's an assessment. I mean, you know, who under 70 is talking about Neil Young's folk rock these days? So, I mean, what do they have to lose by going against Neil Young?
Well, but then Barry Manilow, I think this morning, has taken Neil Young's side. I think he's going to be removing his music from Spotify. I know Peter Frampton sent out a tweet in the last 24 hours supporting.
Oh, Christian.
Did we lose
there?
Christian? Oh, sorry. You cut out there for a second. You cut out there for talking about Peter Frampton. Sorry.
Yeah, I just saw a tweet from him basically supporting Neil Young. So I don't think this is over. I think this is an ongoing story. And if you see more and more artists take Neil Young's side, I don't know. Spotify may buckle.
All right, Christian, are you keeping a list of actors and musicians and, you know, people that have been canceled by the cancel culture?
I mean, it's what I cover all the time, and it's obviously covered in my book. So, yeah, that's a particular interest for me and how they recover or how they don't recover sometimes.
Well, I can't even remember the Roseanne Barr tweet. Can you help me out?
Yeah, so she tweeted a comparison between Valerie Jarrett, who is black and from the Obama administration, comparing her to someone from the Planet of the Apes. So that's a horrible tweet on its surface. She claimed she didn't know that Valerie Jarrett was a black person. You could go back and forth on that. The bottom line, it was a pretty gross tweet. It was racist in nature, potentially, assuming that you take it at face value. She apologized immediately, but then lost, you know, was basically kicked out of her show, her own show, and of show business. I mean, she hasn't made any sort of comeback. And that was 3 or 4 years ago.
Was there anybody accused of doing something wrong that you think they were wrongly accused, if that makes sense, or canceled wrongly?
Yeah, I mean, Gina Carano is a perfect example. I mean, she sent out some tweets and social messages, which you could agree with, you could disagree with, not the end of the world. And Disney fired her and said that she was that it had an anti-Semitic nature to it. It didn't at all. You could go Google the old information. So there are plenty of times that people get canceled for unfair reasons. I think she may be the most extreme example. And just for comparison's sake, Bette Midler sends awful, horrible, terrible tweets all the time. She's been cheering on violence against Senator Rand Paul, for example, and nothing happens to her.
Of course.
So that's why this whole woke crusade is inauthentic and I'm being kind.
because there's no consistency there.
Yeah, I mean, it's right. So before I suggest something, give us your sort of calculus, the Hollywood calculus for whether or not you get targeted for elimination or not.
If anyone does, you mean?
Yeah. What's the standard? Why you use Bette Midler versus Gina Carano? I could throw out, somebody nobody ever heard of other than his affiliation with Mumford & Sons. Mumford & Sons guitarist. He gets banned. He has to issue an apology because he wrote a tweet in support of Andy Ngo's book about Antifa. I mean, just ridiculous stuff. So why does Mumford & Sons guitarist, why do they target him? Why do they target Gina Carano, who's not a super well-known actress, They leave a Bette Midler alone?
It's often about politics. Gina Carano appeared to be right of center and or just poking the bear, and by bear I mean the narrative. Andy Ngo is loathed by the left because he exposes what Antifa is all about. So those are the qualifications there. Again, it's not always consistent because sometimes the woke mob will pursue liberal people. Tina Fey has been attacked in the past. Will Ferrell has as well. Amy Schumer. So those are sort of very traditionally left of center stars who still get attacked by the cancel culture mob. But it's not as ferocious. It's not as intense. And, so that's you have to kind of put that into the calculation.
Is Hollywood moving shop or slowly but surely? I saw this week producer Ryan Kavanaugh is leaving Los Angeles, and you're hearing more and more high-profile L.A. types, Hollywood big shots like this Kavanaugh character, saying that he founded that video sharing app Triller, I guess, saying, I can't be here anymore. And it's not because of the politics, but it's because of the result of the politics, which is, for example, the lawlessness.
Yeah, I think that will happen to a certain degree. I still think L.A. is going to be an epicenter of sorts for Hollywood. But yeah, Joe Rogan famously left for Texas, and others have as well. At the end of the day, if you're not safe, it doesn't matter how woke you are, how politically left of center you are, you might want to kind of get out of Dodge. And I think that's, you'll see some of that in a limited degree.
Well, and that the murder in Beverly Hills of that music producer's wife, Avant, right? That supposedly shook up some of the jet set in Hollywood.
Yeah, and there was a murder of a young woman in a furniture warehouse, which just seemed random and crazy vicious and got a lot of attention. So there are a lot of different reasons why things happen. I think many, many people still look past the impact of these policies and remain in these cities and keep voting the way they do vote. So I used to be more optimistic about people kind of waking up and having common sense, whether it's inside or outside of Hollywood. I have less of that now.
You mentioned Me Too movement. We were talking about Hef and Harvey Weinstein. And so where does that stand now, a couple of years removed, and other more pressing leftist political agenda items moving ahead of it? Is the Me Too movement, is there been some sort of paradigm shift in Hollywood with respect to the predation of old men on young women mainly?
I don't know. I hope there has been some change behind the scenes. I certainly think because the focus is on it more, that if someone was in trouble, facing that kind of situation, they'd be more open to speak out because there'd be more people willing to listen and protect them. But, in recent years, we've seen a group called Time's Up, which was an organization meant to help women like that. And a lot of these celebrities were rallying behind it, throwing thousands and thousands of dollars behind it. And that organization, it's still there, but it basically reassembled because it was so fraudulent and so pathetic and so corrupt. I mean, they were helping Governor Cuomo in New York with his messaging. So, go Google that as well. It's a horrible story. And, of course, none of the celebrities who backed that organization have been held accountable, have been really pressed by the media about, hey, why did you back this organization? And then not, make sure they're doing the right thing. So it's just another chapter in Hollywood history.
All right. I mean, since you're an art critic, I got to ask you this, too. Are you an Ozark watcher?
I loved the first season, and I started watching season two, and I just drifted away, and I don't know if it's necessarily the show's fault or I just got pulled in different directions, but I there's much to admire there for sure.
I love that show.
Have you, Amy, watched the first seven episodes of the fourth season, the final season?
I'm on episode seven, so please do not ruin it for me.
No spoiler alert.
Seriously.
No spoiler alerts. But it's just it seems like one of these patterns too, where these even good shows, most of them, I mean, some can break the mold, but most of them by the fourth or fifth season, it just seems like the writers have lost the plot, because the fourth season of Ozark. I mean, there are just so many plot points that are just so
ridiculous.
Yeah, they're just not credible, and there's just too many gaps. And it almost seems like they didn't really plan this out. They're like, we need to get to this end, and we're going to sort of work backwards to figure it out, rather than like unfurling a story like they did in the first season.
Well, it does happen. Some shows actually get stronger as they go along.
Yep,
but they may be the exception, not the rule.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
We're like, they're not going to look for the sheriff's car, you know, things like that, right?
Oh, spoiler alert.
Oh, that was in the first episode.
Christian Toto, founder of HollywoodInToto.com, the right take on entertainment, award-winning film critic, author of the just-released Virtue Bombs, How Hollywood Got Woke and Lost Its Soul. Christian, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day. Then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now! Open mic Friday!
Dan and Amy, it's that time of the week. Open mic Friday, taking your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line with comments, criticisms, compliments, general crack pottery. We'll take it all. And Amy, I know you're hot to trot on what Cook County Chief Judge Tim Evans had to say to the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce. Or not. Okay. Well, then let's go to the lines. Leo in Wicker Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan and Amy, I love your show. And what you were saying about politicians never being able to admit wrong, and then that your part about Hollywood being so hypocritical, it pervades our society all over. It even goes to, like, you know, just common media, radio hosts and guests. And I have a Supreme Court nominee, Anita Hill.
Okay. Well, I hope Joe Biden nominates Anita Hill for you, Leo.
You know, the pubic hair and the soda can. Okay.
Yeah, thank you. I remember the confirmation hearings. Yeah.
It's the name of your band, right?
Yeah. Thanks, Leo. I really hope, Leo, I hope that happens. I really hope your dream comes true, because I, for one, would be happy. Clarence Thomas probably doesn't want to deal with it again. Maybe he does. I don't know. But I, for one, would be happy to relitigate Anita Hill. And I can't think of a better environment to do it than a Senate Judiciary confirmation hearing. I would love it, Leo. Thank you so much for the call and the recommendation. I love when it's a leftist who is the willing participant in their own demise. Rick in Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning. Hey, you were talking earlier to the woman who wants to run for the school president in Chicago. And I'm not as perceptive I'm not as perceptive picking up stuff as you guys are. But when they start using phrases like resources and we have to have a conversation, I instantly think, like, she's going to do the exact same thing they all do. And I think Bill Bennett said one time that you can plot the decline of the American education system with the advent of the teachers union, and that's the problem. These overpaid people producing an inferior product being protected by the union. And until you do something about that, nothing's going to change.
Thanks for the call, Rick. Yeah, you know, when you have people string together buzzwords, I mean, she may be a very nice person, but what she offered was just can't. Transparency, stakeholders, collaboration, rinse and repeat. Yeah, I didn't get the sense that there was really that much difference.
Yeah.
I didn't, and actually, I'm glad we had her on, because I think she's a good example of why there's no reason to believe anything is going to change anytime soon within the Chicago public school system or Chicago more generally. By the way, speaking of which, Chicago public school teachers, we didn't get to this with her, part of their mandatory training, a PowerPoint presentation, you know, in the webinar form that they're required to take.
I took it.
Supporting transgender, non-binary, and gender non-conforming students. Gender and sex are socially constructed, meaning they've been created and enforced by the people in a society. The concepts of gender and sex are actually not rooted in biology. Instead, they are socially constructed, which means they've been created and enforced by people in a society. These slides. People have layers of identity. And also this, you know how we asked her the question, who's the primary stakeholder in the education of their children?
Right.
And she said, effectively, the parent. Well, that's not what CPS is saying with this teacher mandatory, this mandatory teacher training. From the slides, discussing a student's transition with their parent or guardian without the student's explicit consent is not permitted.
Yep, which gives control of the child to the teachers and the teachers' union.
Also, parental consent not required for a student name, gender marker, or pronoun change.
Right.
And if you don't abide the name, gender marker, pronoun change, then you're subject to disciplinary action.
Correct.
Uh-huh. It's going very well in CPS and in so many other districts.
And you know what's where it's not going well is Cook County State's Attorney's Office, because I thought the problem, Dan, was Kim Fox. And yesterday, Chief Judge Tim Evans spoke, and he lied, first of all, right off the bat. Listen to this lie.
As we check the records, there's not been anybody who's been charged with murder or attempted murder added to the sheriff's electronic monitoring since October of last year.
That is a lie, because we checked, and there's 102 people right now. It used to be 92 6 months ago. Now there's 104 people who've been charged with murder or attempted murder who are out on electronic monitoring.
He said since October.
Of last year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. Okay. Well,
but
still.
So the larger point is, yes, he's picking an artificial starting point since October of last year, 3 months ago. Well, what about more generally? And more generally, of course, your point is the overridingly important one.
But he doesn't even want electronic monitoring for juveniles.
Personally, I would prefer not to have electronic monitoring. I believe therapy is better.
Therapy? And he talked specifically about the 16-year-old who was charged officially as an adult yesterday. By the way, two prior carjackings, a possession of a stolen vehicle, that was his. And he was out on probation, not on electronic monitoring. But still, if he was in charge, I think he would have let him out or had him at least post bond.
Don't have the prefrontal cortex that is developed. And the prefrontal cortex of the brain does not itself fully develop until you're closer to the age of 25 years of age. This kid is 16. There's no way that he would have the prefrontal cortex already developed. So while I can't talk about that particular case, I'm just talking about the typical 16-year-old. He doesn't have that part of the brain developed that makes it possible for him to distinguish between the right thing to do and the wrong thing to do.
Really?
I mean, that is frightening, Dan.
So he's talking about the kid who allegedly killed Melissa Ortega, that 8-year-old in Little Village. So then nobody should be charged until the age of 25 when their prefrontal cortex is fully developed, according to Chief Judge Evans, because they don't know right from wrong.
I mean, that is some scary, sickening stuff. And all along I thought this was Kim Fox. It's Kim Fox and Chief Judge Tim Evans the city.
All along we've known that it's the people in charge. The executive is Lori Lightfoot.
Right.
The prosecutor is Kim Fox. The chief judge is Tim Evans. We've said that any number of times. And the Chicago Police Department and the Cook County Sheriff's Department, to the extent that the people in charge of those departments are politicians and not law enforcement officers who do the bidding of those other politicians that I mentioned. So that would include Chief Brown and Tom Dart as well.
And yesterday we learned in court, I mean, you know, he may not be have a fully formed brain, but he sure had fun, because after he killed Melissa Ortega, two shots to the head, by the way, not one, He and his 27-year-old getaway driver, who was driving a cab, by the way, they were seen on surveillance video laughing, having fun, having drinks, eating Subway sandwiches. And then later on that night, they drove back around by her memorial to just look at the work that they did.
So the question is that right? A 16-year-old doesn't know right from wrong.
Yeah.
And so a 16-year-old is not responsible for what they do because they don't know right from wrong. Tim Evans wants to take it to 25, perhaps. At least that's what he seemed to insinuate. So, okay, nobody knows right from wrong until Tim Evans says they do. He's the chief judge in Cook County.
Unbelievable.
Marilyn Lombard.
Hello. I wanted to make a comment because of your person yesterday from Glenbard South, the history teacher who quit. Mm-hmm. I received my newsletter from District 87 from Superintendent Larson, and it's a very nice little newsletter, and it's mentioning belonging and the practice of equity journey 8 times is all equity. There's no equality whatsoever. And the entire brochure is talking about helping minority students, which is fine. I have no problem with that, but that's it. And the focus is totally on equity, belonging, empowering, and they call it the journey. It's the culture and practice of equity journey. Yeah. And I also wanted to add that teacher that is at Glenbard South last year, that principal did leave, got out of the Pledge of Allegiance during the graduation.
Right,
so
she
I'm
forgot
sure
the words.
That,
yeah, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, I can see where this guy would be very uncomfortable, and it's a shame because District 87 used to stand for everybody. And they know, in my opinion, looking at this newsletter that just came out, I don't believe it anymore.
Well, thanks for the call, Marilyn. That superintendent there in the Glenbard schools, Larson, you mentioned, he's an identitarian hack, which is what most of these superintendents are. So I would start from that as the premise. You know, we're talking about heads of agencies, heads of branches of government, heads of schools. Same problem. And that fish rots from the head down, doesn't it? Mike in Lakeview.
Good morning, everybody. Amy, I got one for you and I got one for Dan.
Okay.
Amy, I'm Italian, and my preferred pronouns are these, thems, and those.
And we're going to go to the Jules.
We're going to Jules.
Yeah.
And Dan, for you, do you realize if Jen Psaki was married to Dick Durbin, her name would be Jen Psaki Durbin?
It's pretty good, Mike.
Thanks Mike.
For the call. Terry Rogers Park.
Hey, I think policemen, for their own safety, should always have their weapons drawn when entering a building with any kind of domestic violence going on. Those two policemen murdered in New York would still be alive if they had. Mm-hmm. And I also think that brain cortex stuff is a bunch of crap.
I mean, it's frightening.
Thanks for the call, Terry. Yeah, those are some statements from Chief Judge Tim Evans. Boy, you know, wow. I thought his expertise was in the field of law, you know, because
right.
he's a chief judge. I had no idea that he is such an accomplished neurologist.
Yeah, oh, that's right, neurology, yes.
Dave in Downers Grove.
His minor.
Yeah, guys. Hey, good morning. I think we should use Judge Evans' information. Instead of having sentences like 5, 10 years, we should just keep them until they're 25. So if they're 18 and they're like this kid, keep them in for 7 years.
Oh, there you go. Thanks for the call, Dave. And I mean, obviously, the other things that we need to do, if under the Evans standard of your fully formed prefrontal cortex, probably shouldn't vote until you're 25.
Well, that right, or serve the country, go to war.
Can't be drafted.
Service, can't be drafted. Shouldn't get married because you know you might be choosing the wrong woman if your brain's not developed.
Can't own a gun.
No, yeah.
Ken, let's have that fight.
What about driving a car? I mean, yeah. It's
voting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 25, huh? 16-year-old doesn't, I mean, just even forgetting that silliness for a second. A 16-year-old, the 16-year-old who murdered that little girl in Little Village, doesn't know right from wrong because his prefrontal cortex isn't fully formed. No 16-year-olds know right from wrong.
I mean, it's unbelievable. And then we will hopefully get to it Monday. I mean, we have an 11-year-old who carjacked a woman. And the woman spoke, she's like, he was skipping up to me. These are children. Where are their parents? What's going on?
Mount Greenwood, right?
Yeah.
Taylor on the north side. Hi, Taylor.
Hey, guys. I love your show. Keep up the good fight. Amy, you do such a good job of keeping all of us informed about what's going on with the school system and all these kids. It's just absolutely heartbreaking. I'm only in my mid-20s, and I'm, like, fearful to have a kid because it's frightening what's going on in these schools. And you guys you keep all of us at ease. So just keep up the good fight and have a good weekend.
Don't be afraid to have children. Just move to a different state or, at the very least, the suburbs.
There you go. Keith and Kankakee.
Yeah, good morning. I have a family member who's a probation officer. And even down in conservative Kankakee County, the judges give more respect to the criminals, the accused, than they do the probation officers. And with COVID, they just... the accused used COVID as an excuse to not go to meetings. And every court hearing, the judge just says, well, okay, 6 more months probation, and we'll see you in 6 more months. There's no reform. They just, even in Kankakee County.
Thanks for the call, Keith. Mike, Melrose Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. I was wondering if Supreme Court Judge Sotomayor and his Tim Evans went to the same medical school. Because they're both spewing medical stuff and have no idea what they're talking about.
God, yeah, that's right. Such a good point.
Yeah, Sotomayor, the epidemiologist, and Tim Evans, the neurologist. Uh-huh. They just sort of practice law on the side. You know, epidemiology, neurology, that's their real respective calling. Bob, Buffalo Grove.
Oh, hi, Bob.
Good morning, Amy and Dan. Thanks for taking the call, and thank you for keeping us informed on COVID issues like the restaurant reservation data today. And Amy keeps us abreast of the COVID protocols and the athletics. But let me offer the following. STEM education, something I've been involved in for 25 years, has been, you know, canceled for like 2 years. There's just haven't been any programs, and a few of them have gone virtual. But I got some good news, sort of. The annual IIT Bridge Contest for high school physics students is going to return on February 8th. That's the good news. And vax cards won't be required. But the bad news
is Pete Buttigieg is presiding?
No. Yeah. Masks are required.
That's fine.
And you have to show or provide negative COVID tests before you enter the competition. Unbelievable.
All right. Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, they've been suppressed for 2 years. They haven't had their annual event.
Built bridges all my life and one little, never mind. Rich, Northside.
Yeah, how you doing?
How you doing?
If that's true, what Timothy Evans said, and I guess we can't send guys that are 18 years old to defend our country because they're not fully developed yet mentally. And I guess they can't go to war then. I mean, who says something like that? And this guy's a judge?
Chief judge.
Chief judge.
Thanks for the call, Rich.
And he had his own electronic monitoring system. Now, I wish I was there yesterday. I would have asked, you know, what is the side hustle you have?
I think Chief Judge Evans and Kim Fox and Lori Lightfoot and Tom Dart, I think they should be on electronic monitoring. We need to know where they are at all times.
Exactly. And did you see what Mayor Lightfoot just tweeted out? She's such a tryhard. She tried to get vax and she spelled it out in cash. But that's what gangbangers do before they go kill their rivals. I mean, she is so...
Seems appropriate.
And then put a phone number like, you want cash? Get vaxxed.
Yeah.
You got to see it. I tweeted it out.
She's another officer of the court, former
dear
prosecutor.
Dear Lord.
Yeah, don't forget, Lightfoot, not just the mayor, former federal prosecutor.
I wonder if she thinks that they should get therapy rather than electronic monitoring if they're juveniles,
Maybe somebody can ask her. Bob, Edison Park.
Hey, guys, kind of going a different direction than what you're talking about. John Bolton, you probably won't agree with me. I think the guy's a complete scumbag. I think he's proved it. He's nothing but a neocon warmonger. The only thing that the only encouraging thing when he talked was I was shocked he wasn't calling out for all out invasion into Ukraine before the Russians get there. This guy has never seen a war he didn't like, and now he's backpedaling. This guy slammed Trump, backstabbed Trump, and now he's complaining that the oil's gone, the pipeline's gone. Well, Bolton, it's kind of your fault that you did it with your Lincoln Project buddies. And as far as Iran, Dan, I'm over 50 years old. Iran has been 6 months from a nuke for the 50 years that I've been alive. They want war with Iran so bad, and that's a big reason why I think Bolton hated Trump, because they want a war. Iran's a power. Iran is a power. Give me a break. But China goes unnoticed. And just like the rest of the neocons, he went along the periphery of China, like, oh, yeah, there's something we should do about him. China is the major problem. Iran does not run our entertainment, our banking, our media. It is China. And this is why these neocons have to be called out. Biden, when he had a chance for combat in his own book, his own memoirs, was too much of a coward to go into combat. But he wants to send our children. Forget about it, guys.
All right, Bob. To close it out, see how he's being received in the Sunshine State.
Oh, boy.
Chuck in Delavan, Wisconsin.
Chuck, you're missing the snow.
I know, Chuck from Englewood. I can't believe it.
Englewood, Florida.
Last night, I found
not,
a place.
Not the Englewood, Chicago.
Yeah, I went out dancing at the Waverly yesterday. I had a really nice dinner, me and my girlfriend and that. We met some nice people from South Dakota, and we were dancing with them, and we had a great time. We're headed over to the Venice. They got the big art show in Venice tomorrow.
Yeah. No, that's good. You know, Englewood, you might put stakes down there, Chuck. Englewood's sort of on the come. It could be another hot area, you know, because obviously Venice there and Englewood just outside Sarasota. So you may want to get in on the ground floor there.
Yeah, I know, but there's no consistency. There's a nice house, crystal meth house. Nice house.
That's the problem with Florida. And the driving is just horrific.
Well, I think that's going to change, Chuck. You know, you got to be ahead of the learning curve, not behind it.
Buy the meth house and then tear it down, raise it, and build a nice house.
For Santa. Yeah.
And Santa, and this is closed.
All right, Chuck, thanks for the call. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.